Syria's President Bashar al-Assad is an international outcast, but a rare visit to China is giving him a boost.
He desperately needs money. The Syrian economy has never been in as worse shape as it is today.
And we meet the most powerful woman in North Korea. She's the Supreme Leader's sister.
She has the authority. It's invested in her by the chairman, by the party and her nation, and she's running her nation's foreign policy.
I'm Carol Hills. Australians are getting excited about ice hockey.
We all realise that we're following a sport that is not that high up in the Australian sporting hierarchy, but for us it's fantastic.
And what the Murdoch succession means for the news landscape in Britain. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thank you for joining us on this Friday. Across Brazil, members of the country's indigenous communities are celebrating. Brazil's Supreme Court has rejected a legal policy known as Marco Temporal. The law put limitations on land claims by indigenous groups.
Então, nós vencemos sim uma batalha, mas não vencemos a guerra. Vamos continuar ainda lutando para que os territórios indígenas sejam
demarcados. Jinamon Tuxá is an indigenous activist who took part in one of those celebrations. He says, yes, we won in a battle, but not in the war. Let's continue fighting so that indigenous lands are demarcated, so that indigenous rights are protected. Ana Alfinito is a lawyer and sociologist based in Sao Paulo. Ana, tell us first about this court case. How significant was yesterday's court ruling?
So what we saw yesterday was possibly the most significant court ruling in the fields of indigenous rights, environmental rights, and the global climate balance. And it's so significant because this ruling, it decides important issues concerning the demarcation, the recognition of all indigenous territories in Brazil.
How did this Marco Temporal legal rule work? What's the history behind it?
It's a legal invention that was originated in 2009 in a different court ruling and a different judgment. It basically says that indigenous peoples only have the right to the land that they actually occupied or effectively disputed in 1988, which is the date of the federal constitution of its enactment here in Brazil. So what it does is it says that all the lands that were not actually occupied or legally disputed on that date are not indigenous and cannot be recognized as indigenous lands. And yesterday, the Supreme Court decided that no, the federal constitution does not contain within it any temporal cutoff for indigenous land rights. The Supreme Court of Brazil reaffirmed that indigenous peoples are entitled to their traditional territories. And what traditional here means is that these are territories with which indigenous peoples still have material, symbolic, or spiritual ties. This is what matters. What matters is the type of relationship that exists between indigenous communities and the territories they demand. This is what makes a land indigenous, not a presence on a specific date, such as the temporal cutoff thesis argued.
Who brought this case to Brazil's Supreme Court and why?
So this political thesis, it came up in the Supreme Court in 2009. And since then, this thesis has been used in many legal suits to block the demarcation of indigenous lands. So today we have at least 220 lawsuits in which anti-indigenous sectors are trying to hinder the demarcation of indigenous lands based on the Marco Temporal. And all of these suits are awaiting judgment of this Marco Temporal case in order to proceed. So they're all suspended. And the fact that this thesis reached the Supreme Court is the result of the work of the indigenous movement.
Beyond the indigenous communities of Brazil, what does this ruling mean more broadly for Brazilians?
So I think different things. The most prominent response, and what we've been reading about a lot, is that indigenous lands, they are very important barriers against social biodiversity loss, against deforestation. So one important number is that indigenous lands in the Amazon today, they occupy 25% of the Amazon in Brazil, and less than 2% of deforestation happens within these lands. So we know that they are very important barriers and protection against environmental degradation. And of course, this is of interest to all of Brazilian society and global society as well.
We've been speaking to Ana Alfanito. She's a lawyer based in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and a legal advisor to Amazon Watch. Thanks for speaking with us, Ana.
Thank you, Carol.
Syria's President Bashar al-Assad is on a rare visit to China. For many years, most of the international community has shunned Assad because of the brutal repression he's unleashed against his own people. But now he's working his way back onto the international stage. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following this story and joins me now. Shirin, why is Bashar al-Assad in China this week?
Well, he's there to attend the opening of the Asian Games that are taking place in the southern Chinese city of Guangzhou. This is a 15-day sporting event that is held every 4 years in a country in Asia. Syrian state media says that Assad was invited by Chinese President Xi Jinping to attend the games and then to meet with Xi on the sidelines. Assad landed in China yesterday, and as he got off the plane with his wife, Asma, he was greeted by Chinese officials. There was a group of performers on the tarmac dancing and waving red flags. So China basically rolled out the red carpet for him.
Okay, so he's attending the Asian Games, he's invited, but what else is Assad looking to get out of this trip?
I mean, already today, there's news of a partnership between Syria and China. China CCTV showed a video of Assad sitting across from Xi Jinping. She's speaking here, and he says Syria is the first Arab country to establish diplomatic ties with the People's Republic of China, and that over the years, the friendship between the two countries has grown even stronger. There was not a lot of detail about what this partnership is about, other than that China is going to help rebuild some of Syria's infrastructure that was destroyed in the war. I should add here, Carol, that China has supported Assad during the war in Syria. It has used its veto power in the United Nations to stop any resolutions against the government in Damascus. And now that the war is at a stalemate and Syria is basically in ruins, Assad is looking for financial help to rebuild his country. This is what Charles Lister told me. He is the director of the Syria program at the Middle East Institute. That's a think tank in Washington.
He desperately needs money and he needs investment. The Syrian economy has never been in as worse shape as it is today.
Lister, though, doesn't see much prospect for China investing heavily in Syria, Carol. He says China will likely wait for Syria to return to the international community in a more concrete way before considering heavy investments there.
So why would Xi invite Assad to China now? I mean, what does China get out of this?
This is part of China's plans to expand its influence across the Middle East in general. In March, China brokered a deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran. These are two bitter enemies, and now they have reopened embassies and resumed diplomatic ties. And then in June, Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas visited Beijing. Xi Jinping proposed a peace plan that would help end the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So overall, China wants to be seen as a major power in the Middle East.
Now, getting back to Assad, has he been successful at making a comeback? I mean, are countries resuming ties with Syria now?
In some ways, yes. In the past year or so, Assad has been able to make a slow but steady return to the international scene. Back in May, the Arab League readmitted Syria. It had taken it off during the war. And then Assad went on a tour of countries in the region, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. But Charles Lister says at the end of the day, we're probably not going to see a lot of money flowing into Syria anytime soon.
Yes, we'll see meetings, we'll see handshakes. We may very well see some political agreements being announced, but actually in terms of real substance, nothing's going to change.
In the meantime, Carol, as Assad makes these trips, people have been protesting in southern Syria for weeks. And these protests are reminiscent of the ones that we saw in 2011 that sparked the Syrian uprisings. So Assad might want to leave the civil war behind him, but that might prove to be more difficult.
The world's Shirin Jafari. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Carol.
The National Hockey League is skating down under. The Los Angeles Kings and Arizona Coyotes face off in a pair of preseason exhibition games in Melbourne this weekend. It's the league's first foray into the Southern Hemisphere. From Sydney, the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports on the preparations.
Obvious fact of the day, number one. Australia is really far away. Obvious fact of the day, number two. If you want to bring the NHL to Australia, be prepared to schlep. Back in June, the league packed 3 40-foot containers with everything from the rink boards to the pucks and even the Zambonis. The containers traveled by train from Toronto to Philadelphia, then by cargo ship to Charleston, through the Panama Canal, across the equator to New Zealand, and finally to Australia.
Yeah, it's crazy when you think about it.
This is David Proper, the head of international strategy for the NHL. I reached him in Melbourne, where he's watching the Arizona Coyotes practice. He says mounting the games has been quite an undertaking, but it's worth it. And that's because the NHL sees a big opportunity in Australia.
There's a real love for competition and all forms of sport, and they have some of the most passionate sports fans we've ever seen.
Aussies love their rugby, their football, their cricket. The NBA has been big here in recent years. But ice hockey, not so much. Maybe because it never gets truly cold. There are only 20 ice rinks in the whole country. To put that into perspective, Canada has close to 8,000. And yet, hockey fans do exist down under, says Gordon Goodenough, and he is one of them.
I'm biased, but I think hockey is the best live sport you can watch. It's absolutely great.
Goodenough goes to university in Sydney and is co-founder of the blog Hockey Hype Australia. He is about to head to Melbourne for the NHL games, and he is pumped.
I was at uni on Monday, and just randomly, someone that I hadn't even really chatted before, they mentioned that they were going down to Melbourne this weekend. And I said, wow, I am too. And they said, are you going for the ice hockey? And I was like, are you kidding me? Yes. So it's amazing kind of who comes out of the woodwork that's traveling. But there is a real appetite for hockey in this country.
The first game of ice hockey played in Australia that we know about was in 1906. A local team played against American sailors from the USS Baltimore. It was a tie. Today, Australia has its own semi-pro league, the Australian Ice Hockey League. It has 10 teams.
Ryan McGuinness, but Mustangs will go out and away. Krotoshka couldn't stop it going
Jeff
forward.
Jeff Koop does commentary for the Melbourne Mustangs and the Melbourne Ice.
Centers it up. Here's a chance at the back score!
We all realize that we're following a sport that is not that high up in the Australian sporting hierarchy, but for us, it's fantastic. For us, it is the best.
He wishes it were easier to get the word out about local games. He says people aren't even aware there is an Australian ice hockey league.
I can't tell how many people I've had turn around to me in the last few years since I've moved to Melbourne being like, oh, I didn't even know we had a team down here. It's like, no, you haven't got one. You've got two teams down here and the best rink in the country. And so we dragged them along to games and they go, oh, this is actually really cool. I didn't realize we were this good at ice hockey. And you're going to temper them a little bit because we're not that good. But the standard they're seeing is still a very high quality.
Coop is psyched for the NHL preseason games this weekend, but he's even more psyched for what the games can do to nurture a love of ice hockey in Australia. He says once Australians see ice hockey played live, they'll be hooked. And then maybe they'll seek out local hockey. Wouldn't that be something? For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. This video shows the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, boarding his personal passenger train after his recent visit with Vladimir Putin. Joining him for the week-long visit to Russia was his younger sister, Kim Yo-jong. Here she is in 2018 in Panmunjom, near the border between North and South Korea. She's standing with North Korea's political elite as Kim Jong-un welcomes South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Later that spring, she was in Singapore, attending her brother's summit with the U.S. president.
The letter that we're signing is very comprehensive, and I think both sides are going to be very impressed with the result.
That's her standing right next to Kim Jong-un, handing him the pen to sign a joint statement with Donald Trump. Kim Yo-jong is often seen with her brother, who is the supreme leader of North Korea. She is young, attractive, composed, and according to our next guest, she may be the most dangerous woman in the world. Sung-yeon Lee is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. His new book is called The Sister. Sung-yeon Lee, we'll get to the dangerous part in a minute, but first, tell us about Kim Yo-jong's relationship with her brother Kim Jong-un.
Well, what I see in the two siblings, the supreme leader and his sister, is genuine love, affection, trust between the two. You know, the two often look at each other at public affairs, events like summit meetings, and they smile as if to communicate to each other, oh, this day's going swimmingly. And it's clear to me that she has the absolute trust of her brother. And in her more than 40 statements, it's clear, often she says so, that she has the authority it's invested in her by the chairman, by the party, and her nation, and she's running her nation's foreign policy.
You write that Kim Yo-jong and her brother, Kim Jong-un, were raised as royalty. What privileges did they have? What kind of childhood are we talking about?
Oh, absolutely spoiled, lavish life. As children to this present day. We think North Korea is poor. Yes, the nation is poor. For an industrialized nation, you see almost half the population undernourished, according to the United Nations. But the regime, the dynasty, is filthy rich. They live like absolute kings. They are very spoiled and don't show much regard for the well-being of their own people.
Kim Yo-jong was given control of the North Korean propaganda department in 2014 when articles in the state media suddenly were filled with profanity, aggressive racism, sexism, and homophobia. Should we assume that she wrote those articles?
I think so. I didn't really understand it at the time, but because since 2020, Kim Yo-jong has issued over 40 statements in her own name, which all of them, you know, they carry this vituperative verbal twist. They're very sarcastic and quite nasty. One has to assume that she was running this powerful propaganda and agitation department in 2014 and 2015 when we saw a deluge of racist, homophobic, sexist statements about the then South Korean female president. North Korea continually, frequently referred to her, President Park, as, I don't know if I can say this on air, but quote, dirty old prostitute, stinky Obama pelvis licking, skirt lifting, dirty old whore. Those were staples, and I think that's a signature snark of the sister Kim Yo-jong. And when you see her in public, she is very haughty. She carries herself erect posture, chin up a little, and often wears what I call a Mona Lisa smirk smile. She's smiling, but there's a heavy shade of smirk, mockery, and self-absorption in her personage, in her public aura.
Well, speaking of public appearances, I know there are very few videos of Kim Yo-jong speaking, but here's one. She's speaking to an auditorium full of dignitaries and military. What is she saying here?
So that was the first public speech by her aired on North Korean television, and it's from August 2022. She is claiming that the spread of COVID in her nation was intentionally transmitted by South Korean human rights activists, whom she refers to as human scum, human trash, that they had intentionally contaminated leaflets criticizing the North Korean dynasty and sent them via balloons.
We're speaking with Sung-yeon Lee, author of a new book about the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Now, the North Korean leadership can be ruthless, to say the least. Disappearances and executions for disloyalty are commonplace. What do we know about Kim Yo-jong's involvement in any of this sort of thing?
Well, when it comes to North Korea, it's really hard to establish and confirm facts. But we've had reports from people inside North Korea, from different regions within the country, report that Kim Yo-jong, as of about May 2021, has been issuing execution orders. You know, she's been playing God, the role of God. She decides who lives, who dies, who's tortured, for what crime, alleged crime, for looking at her in a funny way, for getting on her nerves. And it's believable, these reports, rumors are believable, because this, the power to kill anyone you don't like, who looks at you, who claps, applauds half-heartedly, so-called, that was one of the charges made against their uncle, who was killed in 2013. These are the prerogatives of the supreme leader, both the present one and his father and grandfather. And now this female figure has that prerogative to kill on a whim. And that speaks to her real power.
You've written an entire book about her, and it's clear that you think she is incredibly dangerous. What do you want people to understand about her? What do you want, you know, the American government or other people who want to somehow deal with North Korea or want to see some sort of agreement between the two Koreas? What made you feel like you needed to write this book?
Thank you for that question. When we look at North Korea, the supreme leader with his funny haircut and the crazy sounding things he says he's going to nuke the White House and so on, it's hard not to mock North Korea because they're so weird. They are, you know, an amalgam of weird mix of medieval mores and buffoonish bellicosity. It's hard not to patronize them, but they are not a joke when it comes to military power. They are not to be underestimated. And North Korea, contrary to public perception that it's unpredictable, no, it's approximately predictable. They don't just go berserk all out. They know when to climb down the ladder of escalation and with a very charming smile call for talks, peace talks, denuclearization talks, and all those good things. So when that time comes, when North Korea resorts to, goes back to a post-provocation peace ploy phase, when that time comes, I believe Kim Il-jung will be the face of the new charm offensive. At that moment, yes, talk to her, talk to North Korea, but don't patronize her just because she's a young, relatively young female figure. Don't think that she is more malleable than her surly-looking brother. Be careful, because they have a plan. The other side often does not.
Sung-yeon Lee is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's been talking with us about his new book, The Sister. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. When an asteroid got close enough to Earth, NASA launched a mission to scoop up some samples of asteroid dust.
Imagine trying to scoop your coffee from thousands of kilometers away. That would be a hard thing to do, and it's no different for spacecraft.
Why bother? Well, scientists think that dust could contain clues about how our solar system came about. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It wasn't even close. The biggest Hollywood movie of the summer was about a doll.
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Ken!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Ken!
Besides Barbie, there was Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, and Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. What you may not realize is that all three were filmed, at least in part, in the United Kingdom. The British film industry is hugely dependent on Hollywood, and the strike by U.S. writers and actors is starting to have an impact across the pond, as The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Charlotte Sewell has worked on dozens of movies. She's a costume designer living in London. But when this news broke in LA in mid-July...
This morning, for the first time in 63 years, two major Hollywood unions have walked off the job, bringing the film and TV industry to a halt.
Sewell says she knew it spelled trouble for her.
I mean, I was on Mission Impossible, so, I mean, you know who I've got. So we couldn't continue, because without him, we don't have a film.
Tom Cruise wasn't the only actor to walk off the set. Several of his US co-stars joined the protest too. The latest Mission Impossible movie was being filmed partly in Norway, Malta and South Africa. But most of the shoot was scheduled to happen in Britain. Sewell got a couple more days' work before the set shut down. But for most of her colleagues, she says, the impact of the strike was immediate.
It was overnight. Some people were literally told, that's it, don't come in tomorrow.
The actors are striking over basic pay and working conditions and the use of AI. they want guarantees about how artificial intelligence will be used by the studios in the future. As actors marched outside film and TV studios in LA, British actors and crew members held a solidarity march in London.
One struggle, one fight. We support SAG-AFTRA strike. One struggle, one fight. We support SAG-AFTRA strike.
Brian Cox, who plays Logan Roy in the HBO hit series Succession, was at the London protest. Cox says he worries about the impact of AI on actors like himself, but the writers who've been striking in the US since last May must be listened to too, he says.
Because without writers, we're nothing. You know, we can't do anything. Somebody said we're just like pieces of furniture without writers. And when they start getting at the writers, they're getting at the very fundament of what we do.
Almost $8 billion was spent on film and TV productions in the UK last year. 86% of that came from Hollywood studios and major streamers like Netflix and Amazon. The UK is attractive to US film companies because of its generous tax breaks, but Marcus Ryder with the film and TV charity says it's much more than that.
Since those tax breaks have been brought in, the UK has been able to build up a infrastructure which makes it incredibly appealing. It's got a skill base which is incredibly appealing, and our post-production is also fantastic.
Ryder's charity provides hardship grants to crew members who are struggling. It's almost 100 years old, but Ryder says he's never seen it this bad.
We're seeing people suffering in a way that we've never seen before. The closest we can think about is COVID.
Even then, Ryder says, the government stepped in and offered financial aid. This time around, he says, production crews in Britain feel abandoned.
You look at the unions in America, and those unions have a dedicated fund to help people on strike. You also have massive celebrities like Steven Spielberg, like Oprah Winfrey, who are dedicating large amounts of money to people who have been affected by the strikes.
Ryder says apart from his charity, there's no such fund for British production crews affected by US strikes. And the UK government hasn't been helpful either, he says. Costume designer Charlotte Sewell is with Bechtu, a union that supports production staff in Britain. She says the union is fully supportive of the US actors and writers' strikes, but still, she says, she worries about how she's going to pay her mortgage next month.
I mean, yesterday I was literally looking at thinking, what are my transferable skills and what else can I do?
Sewell says lots of her colleagues have already switched careers, and if they leave this business, she says, they may never come back. And that will be devastating for Britain's film and TV industry. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The asteroid named Bennu is what scientists call a near-Earth asteroid. But here's some good news. It is not on a collision course with Earth, at least not this century, but it has come close enough for a NASA spacecraft to circle it and scoop up a sample of pristine asteroid dust. That dust may contain clues about the origins of our solar system. Carly Howitt has been following all of this. She's a professor of space instrumentation at the University of Oxford in the UK, which is where we caught up with her. Carly, I got to ask, when we say near Earth, how far away are we talking about in terms of where this asteroid is?
Yeah, you'll be pleased to learn that near Earth doesn't really apply to what we think of in real life as being very close. So this is, by space terms, it's pretty near, but it's a long way from the Earth. We haven't got to worry about it too much. And it took OSIRIS-REx a good few months to get there. So again, not much chance of hitting the Earth. We're dealing with thousands of kilometers.
OSIRIS-REx is the name of the spacecraft. And I know this whole saga of having the spacecraft get close enough to the asteroid to scoop up some dust, it's been playing out for a few years, right?
Absolutely. It's quite a complex thing to do. It doesn't sound too bad. You know, we all scoop coffee in the morning. But when you've got a remotely operated spacecraft that's trying to just touch the surface of a very low gravity asteroid, what you don't want to do is hit the surface and get pushed back away. You know, there's not much gravity to keep you on that body. It's a small, low mass target. What you want to do is come in very slowly, scoop gently a little bit of the material, and then be able to safely leave your asteroid. And so that tag procedure, it's been called, has been planned for a long time. It was quite the operation. You know, imagine trying to scoop your coffee from thousands of kilometers away. That would be a hard thing to do. And it's no different for spacecraft.
So how do they actually do it? Is there like a scooper on the side of OSIRIS-REx that kind of scoops it and plops it inside the spacecraft? How does it work?
Pretty much, actually. So they have a sort of an arm that comes out, right? You don't want to take the body of your spacecraft down to the target. So there's an arm that comes out, and it's sort of got like a grabbing claw. If you've ever played those games in an arcade, there's a grabber, and it comes down and usually grabs a stuffed toy. It's a little bit like that. So it has sort of a grabber that comes in, scoops up a pristine sample of this asteroid, and then stores it safely on board the spacecraft to be able to be sent back to Earth.
So did it just do it once, just one little pass by, and the scooper came out and got it?
No. So they originally got there in 2018, and they've spent about 3 or 4 years looking at the surface of the target, figuring out where the best place to do this scoop, right? You want to look at the surface and try and find an area that's relatively free of boulders. You don't want to, you know, get down to scoop dirt and instead encounter a big rock. So the whole process actually took a really long time.
It's amazing. It's just incredible to even visualize. Now, why is asteroid dust so special? I mean, how exactly could it reveal secrets about the origins of the solar system?
Well, the trouble with the Earth is it has lots of ways that we alter the surface, right? If you look at, you know, just outside your window, you'll see some form of weather, be it rain or snow or wind. And we have plate tectonics here on a big scale. The rock that we have on the surface of the Earth over millions of years gets recycled back down into the mantle. So it's really hard to look at Earth rock and understand how the Earth was millions of years ago. But these small bodies, these small asteroids, and other targets like them give us a taste of what the surfaces of rock and material were like when they were formed, because they don't have wind and rain and other things that can change that surface. So by looking at these asteroids that are close to the Earth but aren't Earth, enables us to get a glimpse back in time, if you like, at what the solar system around us must have been like millions of years ago.
So what becomes of this dust once it lands? How is it treated and analyzed in labs?
So there's a consortium of scientists around the world that are all signed up to doing certain types of analysis of this dust. Like I said, that sort of feeds into both the global nature of science, but also making sure that we're learning the most we possibly can from this very special sample. As scientists, we want to learn the most we can. We don't really care if the lab, where the lab is, right? And so I'm at the University of Oxford, and we're going to get a small amount of this dust as well, where we can do analysis on the composition and the structure of the dust, and other places across America are going to get it too. And by working using different materials, different techniques, we're really going to be able to drill into what the composition of this thing is, how this grain is structured, how it might have formed. And by working together as sort of a global conglomerate, we're going to maximize our science return.
Carly, will you be watching the landing on Sunday?
Oh, who won't be? Yeah, of course. I know, it's super exciting. And anytime there's a launch or landing, it's always very exciting. And this one's particularly exciting because it really is a very unique opportunity. And we have skin in the game at the University of Oxford. So we'll be holding our breath and watching for that safe return of the material.
Carly Howitt is a professor of space instrumentation at the University of Oxford in the UK. And we've been talking about the arrival, which will happen this weekend, of dust from an asteroid. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
At 16 years old, Yaritza Martinez has gone from being an apple picker in rural Washington to a TikTok sensation to a chart-topping recording artist. But suddenly, her whole career almost came to a halt. Reporter Andalusia K. Soloff went to the heart of Mexico City to find out why.
Tens of thousands of people gather in the rain in Mexico City's main plaza, the Zócalo, to celebrate the country's cry of independence. A verse from a romantic ballad suddenly booms from the stage. That is the melodic voice of the Mexican-American singer Yaritza Martinez. She is rocking her signature style, baseball cap, silver chains, and baggy clothes. Flanked by her two guitar-plucking brothers, Armando and Jairo, she asks the packed plaza, "Yo Why don't I have a heart like that? Like the one they gave you. The one they gave me is fragile. Is that why you broke it so easily? This song, Frágil or Fragile, recorded by Yaritza y Su Esencia along with Grupo Frontera, is part of a new genre that many call urban sireño, that combines traditional Mexican regional music with urban style. Yaritza is one of few female singers in a largely male-dominated scene. Fragile has soared in music charts in the US and in Mexico, and can be heard blaring out of car radio speakers in both countries. However, Yaritza could barely finish singing before hundreds in the crowd started booing her performance. The reason? An unfortunate interview that went viral on TikTok back in August. You see, Yaritza and her brother Jairo were born in a rural farming community in Yakima, Washington. Their parents and older brother Armando had migrated from a small town in Michoacán, rich with traditional music but lacking economic opportunities. Armando, who was formerly undocumented, was recently able to acquire a special visa for artists, which involved him returning to Mexico. Yaritza and Jairo traveled to meet up with him in Mexico City. There they did numerous interviews, and when asked her opinion of Mexico City, this is how Yaritza responded.
Sí me gusta, pero no me gusta cuando me levanto, como me estoy durmiendo, porque se escuchan como los carros y las sirenas de los policías y todo, pero...
Yes, I like it, just not when I wake up and I hear all the cars, she said. And the police sirens and everything. But yes, I like it. It's pretty.
Pues a mí la neta, yo estoy aquí como por más tiempo, pero no me gusta mucho la comida aquí.
Armando then said he preferred the flavor of food in Washington, and Jairo added that he just missed the chicken from home. There was an immediate backlash. They lost hundreds of thousands of followers on TikTok. Ruthless comments started to fill their social networks. Racist memes made fun of how they look and their Spanish accents. They even received death threats. For Luis Escala, a migration and cultural affairs investigator in Mexico's northern border city of Tijuana, the problem is they didn't fit an outdated view of Mexican identity. He believed fans criticized them from their stomachs and not their brains, enraged by their complaints about Mexican cuisine.
Mexican food that you eat over there is better than ours? Well, then you're being arrogant. Then probably it's because you think you're a gringo. Then it is because you think you're an American. You don't think you're a Mexican. You think you're better than us.
That exact sentiment was expressed among concert attendees in the Zócalo over the weekend. Cynthia Boites complained about her presence at the Independence Day celebration.
Sin palabras con Yaritza por lo que opinó sobre nuestro país.
I don't have words for Yaritza, considering what she thinks about our country, she says. The song is nice. It's nice, but it's discredited that she speaks so poorly about our country. Avoites added that she would have preferred a Mexican group to play, while recognizing she herself had come to see Grupo Frontera, or Norteño group from Texas. While many were not pleased with Yaritza's presence, their invitation to perform at the nation's most important independence event came straight from Mexican president himself, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, just a few weeks ago.
Que venga, y que venga ella. Si ya ofrecieron disculpas y además no fue una cuestión de mala fe.
She should come. She already apologized. It wasn't out of bad faith. We shouldn't just cancel this young girl's participation. He went on to recommend that people take the group out for some good Mexican food. Tamales, pozole, or chata. One woman in the Zócalo crowd applauded the president's invitation.
Que ya la perdonemos. Cantó bien bonito y apoyó a México. No, que ya la perdonemos. Salen. Cantó bien bonito.
We have forgiven her. She sings so beautifully and she supports Mexico, she said, and then disappeared into the crowd before giving her name. Standing nearby, teenagers Daphne and Edley said they have issues with Yaritza's attitude. She has good music, they say, but she is lacking in humility. She should recognize who got her where she is. She should be thankful. Luis Escala believes these opinions stem from a lack of understanding from people in central Mexico of those who have migrated north.
People don't consider their youth, they don't consider that they are Mexican-American, and most importantly, they don't consider their social condition. These people are day laborers. I mean, they come from a very, very humble, very poor background. I mean, they were picking up apples at Yakima Valley a few months ago.
Undeterred by the criticism, Yaritza y Su Esencia will now continue their sold-out tour, promoting their new album, Obsessed 2. Across the United States, they'll be singing to their key audience, Mexican migrants and their children. For The World, I'm Andalusia K. Soloff in Mexico City.
A successor is now in place. Lachlan Murdoch, the firstborn son of media mega mogul Rupert Murdoch, has ascended to the top spot at Fox and News Corp. The Murdochs' family values helped inspire the drama in the TV show Succession.
Oh, wow. Well, I gotta say, well done. You won.
Yeah. Yeah. Money wins. Here's to us.
Yes. Here to us.
There's a shot over the shoulder of the patriarch, Logan Roy, as he lifts a glass of champagne. His children are watching for hints about who's next in line to take over. But Logan turns around and goes upstairs. In the real-life story of the Murdochs, it's not just about money, of course. The family's media empire is also seen as a political powerhouse. In Britain, it gets credit for helping the Conservative Party succeed. Simon Potter is a professor of modern history at the University of Bristol. Simon, let's start big here. How would you describe the Murdochs' reach and influence in the UK generally?
So the Murdochs' reach isn't as large, I think, as it was maybe 5-10 years ago, but it's still pretty substantial. They have The Sun, which is one of the most popular tabloid newspapers in the UK, and they also have The Times, and does have, you know, quite a strong subscriber base, and it's seen more of a sort of an elite newspaper.
What are the links between conservative Tory politics and News Corp's coverage and commentary?
We do know that there has been a historic link going back at least to Margaret Thatcher. Clearly, John Major famously benefited from The Sun's support in the election that he won back in the 1990s before Murdoch switched to Tony Blair and New Labour. And again, we've seen pretty clear evidence of links between the Murdoch empire and David Cameron. Rebecca Brooks, who was the editor of the News of the World and then chief of the UK operations of News Corp, is part of that same social set as David Cameron and his wife.
Where does News Corp's power fit into the history of the free press in the UK?
So I think we could see Murdoch as being the direct descendant of a whole line of press barons. The great press baron of the early 20th century was Lord Northcliffe, who was the founder of the Daily Mail. Keith Murdoch in Australia, they called him Lord Southcliffe, the Northcliffe of the Southern Hemisphere. But I think what's perhaps interesting about Rupert Murdoch is that many people see him as the last one of those press barons who've made their money from newspapers and love newspapers. People reckon that Lachlan Murdoch, for example, is not so keen on newspapers. That's not the world or the business that he's grown up with, and is much more keen on digital.
Speaking of Lachlan Murdoch, what do we know about the direction he wants to take News Corp in the UK?
It's not entirely clear because Lachlan Murdoch was out of favour within the News Corp empire for some time before being brought back into the fold. He shares a willingness, at least, to support right-wing political agendas. It's hard to tell what his actual political beliefs are, but he buys into that idea of profiting through right-wing political agendas in the media. He might be keen to divest News Corp of some of its legacy media in cable TV and in print. In Britain, I'm not sure how that would work because, you know, The Sun, The Times, they're still profitable newspapers.
I mean, if you could have dinner with Lachlan Murdoch and ask him any question you wanted, what would you ask?
I suppose I'd want to ask, well, how does it feel to have a chairman emeritus who's also your father watching over your actions as you move into this next stage of your career?
Yeah, because Rupert Murdoch still has a kind of ceremonial post with the whole organization,
yeah,
doesn't he?
Exactly. And I think there's still speculation about, well, how much is he actually going to step back?
What do we know about Lachlan Murdoch's politics or his personality or kind of what floats his boat?
He does seem much more willing to empower people like Tucker Carlson. He seems to be much more behind the support for Trump through Fox News. So what fascinates me the most this sense that the running of a media empire is actually all about individuals and personalities. And I think what Succession beautifully brings across is this sense of people almost captive in this privileged bubble where they are making these enormous decisions, but they're completely disconnected from the reality of most people's everyday existence. You can contrast with that is the idea that actually this is all about corporations making money, and that we can be distracted by these glamorous stories or salacious stories about individuals and their role, and actually it's just all about the money.
Simon Potter, Professor of Modern History at the University of Bristol in the UK. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
More than 45,000 runners are taking to the streets of Berlin this weekend. It's the annual marathon that makes a giant loop around the city. Four-time winner Eliud Kipchoge will be there. He's trying to break his own world record for the 26.2-mile distance. But before any of the runners start the race on Sunday, there's another event taking place tomorrow. Every year, the day before the Berlin Marathon, thousands of inline skaters compete on the marathon course. Participants include professional skaters like reigning champions Bart Swings and Marie Dupuy. They're serious about the race and wear aerodynamic suits, reportedly reaching speeds of more than 40 miles per hour. But most of the 5,000 skaters are in it for fun, wearing costumes and protective gear, like Amanda Murphy.
We have knee pads, elbow pads, helmets. So we are definitely all kitted up.
Murphy flew to Germany from Ireland to skate the race with a group of friends. They've been training for months, but haven't yet mastered how to stop.
We haven't learned that far yet. We really have no idea what we're doing. We are so out of our depth.
Murphy says they're skating the race to raise money for charities, though, and they know they can cover the distance. So for participants like her, it's more about the experience than the time on the clock. You can watch a live stream of the race on the Facebook page, Berlin Marathon Inline Skating. It begins tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.